what Chesterton showed me is something which has become axiomatic to the way I see the world. Chesterton is an exemplification of one who sees reality always in that light, which is the fruit of humility and gratitude. Go.
Welcome to Faith and Culture, a production of the Augustine Institute. Every week, we explore the glory of the Catholic faith and the beauty of Catholic culture. And now, here's your guest host for this week, Dr. Christopher Bloom.
Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Christopher Bloom of the Augustine Institute as a guest host of our Faith and Culture podcast. And it's a great delight for me to be able to put Joseph Pierce on the other side of the mic today.
You always put me in the hot seat. I like
that. Oh, I think so, especially when there's controversy brewing, Joseph.
We love controversy.
And I understand that at the recent meeting of the Chesterton Association, that controversy reared its head.
Yes, indeed. I was as I am usually at the annual Chesterton Conference it moves from one city to another. This year it was in Kansas City, and the news was read out, the actual letter that Dale Olquist, the president of the American Chesterton Society, received from the Bishop of Northampton, basically declining to move forward with the cause for Chesterton's canonization.
Oh my goodness.
And of course you can imagine that wasn't very well received. I mean, actually, to be fair, it was received very charitably.
Yes.
By Dale and by everybody else. No one was making uncharitable remarks about the Bishop of Northampton. On the contrary, and I think Dale responded with disappointment, but with charity. But clearly, the people at the Chesterton Conference didn't agree with the Bishop of Northampton.
One suspects they were on Galileo's side here. Yeah. It was a move.
Yeah, exactly.
But he was a saint. Huh? Yeah. Yes, it moves. Oh, my goodness. Well, but this raises really interesting questions, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I mean, interesting questions. Obviously, do we, can we, should we consider Chesterton the saint? Obviously, he's not a canonized saint. And does that mean we can't consider him to be a saint? What is a saint? Because obviously there are saints, if you like, uppercase S, those that are in the canon, those that we know because of the authority of the church are in heaven and can pray and intercede for us. But of course, most of those saints even, I would say, are saints in that canonized sense because people treated them as saints in the uncanonized sense beforehand. In other words, by having private devotions for them and praying to those holy people for their intercession and for miraculous healing, etc. And those miracles happen, and that's what moves forward the canonization process. So there's two types of saints, if you like. There are those that are officially recognized by the church, and there are those, because, if the only people in heaven are those that are canonized, the rest of us are in big trouble, right?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah,
that's so obviously, clearly, true. There's a host, please God, a host of holy saints in heaven that are not formally recognized by the church. So I think certainly in that latter sense, I have no difficulty at all in considering Chesterton a saint. But obviously, we can't consider him a saint in the canonized sense because he isn't.
Okay, well, let's, in the spirit of Chestertonian paradox here, let's start with the negative case here,
yes.
Right? So why do you suspect that the church in her wisdom has decided at this time not to proceed with the formal process?
Yeah, I think up to a point, I mean, one of the reasons given by the Bishop of Northampton is there's no local cult. But you could probably say the same thing of Saint.
He doesn't spend enough time in pubs.
It's probably true. But you can say the same thing about St. John Henry Newman. The point is that England, in present-day England, is a pretty godless society.
Yeah.
And, you're not going to get a cult with thousands of people going to Chesterton's grave. But there are pilgrimages to Chesterton's grave, and they're growing more of them, but they're more likely to be people from the United States, for instance. Mm-hmm. And I think it's another interesting thing about local cults. St. John Henry Newman, of course, canonized saint of the church now. The two miracles that led to his beatification and subsequently his canonization were miracles through the prayers of Americans, mm-hmm. and miracles to Americans. So really, you know, the fact that you can give an excuse, if that's the right word, or reason, shall we say, to be more charitable, for not pursuing Chesterton's cause as being their no local cult, I think is mm-hmm. not really fair. The more thorny one is the accusation of anti-Semitism, mm. and this is something that has to be grappled. And again, the Bishop of Northampton actually mentioned that as one of the reasons. So the first thing I would say is I do think that I would have to say, and maybe I'm being, you know, I would have to say that the English hierarchy throughout history have not been noted, generally speaking, for their courage. And I'm always thinking of course, at the time of Henry VIII, when mm-hmm. only St. John Fisher had the courage to actually stand up to the might of the state.
Right.
And the rest all basically reneged on Holy Mother Church. And of course, we're not seeing anything on that scale now, but I think we're seeing, you and I talked in an earlier podcast about Mr. Collins. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that Mr. Collins, you know, there were Mr. Collinses even in the Catholic Church. And I think that there's not wanting to rock the boat, not wanting to be controversial, not wanting to upset people. And of course, you know, an accusation of anti-Semitism is a serious accusation. And of course, if it's true, of course Chesterton isn't a saint. Absolutely not. In fact, only by the mercy of God would he be in heaven at all. But of course, that as Dale Oakquist said, we'd answered those accusations, mm-hmm. And convincingly, Chesterton said that, you know, that he and Belloc would die defending the last Jew in Europe. So we need to see the whole thing in the fullness of context. And the fact that an accusation is thrown at somebody, and that alone is enough to scare off,
right,
you know, the faint-hearted, is not the way that you proceed with honesty and integrity and courage. So I think that's part of the problem, if we're going to be honest about this.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay, but how about more generally, right? So, you know, with the Santo Subito types, you know, John Paul, Mother Teresa, and so forth, it's sort of, you know, a tremendous refulgence of light, you know, just good, you know, amazing thing after amazing thing, and so forth. So they sort of overwhelm any possible objection, mm-hmm. right? And even though the various objections were in fact made, but they just seemed to be chirping sectaries, right?
Right.
In Chesterton's case, is there an overwhelming reputation for holiness?
Well, that's a very good discussion. And again, you know, the Augustine Institute published some great books, and one of the very good books that we published relatively recently is Night of the Holy Ghost, A History of G.K. Chesterton by Dale Oakquist, and the first part is The Man. The second part is The Works, and the third part is The Saint? Question marks. And mm-hmm. Dale's not being dogmatic, but in The Man, I think that Dale gives a case of a man of someone who was always full of charity, always animated by a great spirit of humility. And you know, and I speak as one who's brought to Christ, and I always say, and I think it's true, that under grace, obviously give God the glory, but under grace, Chesterton is the biggest single influence on my conversion. That would certainly be true of Dale Oakquist and of numerous others. There's another book out very recently called My Name is Lazarus, which is a collection of essays by people who have been received into the Catholic Church, where Chesterton was at least one of the most significant influences, and it's a chunky volume.
Wow.
So there's that witness in itself. But for me, what Chesterton showed me is something which has become axiomatic to the way I see the world. Chesterton showed me how to see the world that way. And again, we get this from the Summa with St. Thomas Aquinas, you know, that you can't see reality unless you have virtue, and specifically the virtue of humility. And it's that virtue of humility which leads to the sense of gratitude. And that sense of gratitude opens the eyes to wonder, and it's wonder that leads to contemplation, and it's contemplation that opens up the dilatatio, dilates the mind and the soul and the heart into the fullness of reality. Well, I think Chesterton is an exemplification of one who sees reality always in that light, which is the fruit of humility and gratitude. And I seeing it in him was something which created an appetite in me for the same thing. So, you know, in that, you know, I'm not really, my final thing, Chris, on Chesterton's canonization is, look, as I actually said to one of our colleagues earlier, you know, about, he mentioned this, I said, well, I think it will take a miracle. you know, which of course in the worldly sense means it ain't going to happen.
Right, of course.
But yes. The point is, that's what it took for John Henry Newman. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was John Henry Newman, from John Henry Newman's death to his canonization is well over a century, right? 130 years almost.
Right.
So Chesterton has not been dead that long. So, you know, the point is, if we really believe that Chesterton's a saint, we need to practice what we believe mm-hmm. by actually praying for his intercession and praying for miracles. And if those miracles come, you circumvent any worldly objections to his to whether or not we can consider him to be a saint.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I guess here's what occurs to me, and I think the contrast with Newman is a decent one, right? That here's Newman, who, you know, celibate life, personal poverty, freely chosen, tremendous apostolic labors and so forth. I mean, he's sort of, you know, cut off from most of his family after his conversion and so on. There's all kinds of sort of obvious marks of the passion that we see in his life. And so, you know, we expect to see that sort of thing in a saint. By contrast, you know, Bishop Bossuet, the 17th century French preacher who I'm so fond of and who did such great work in spiritual writing and oratory and history and so forth, we don't really see those marks of sanctity in his life. You know, what we would say about him is a remarkably good man, but we're not overwhelmed by holiness. I mean, one of the facts is that he died a wealthy man, you know, right. And that doesn't mean that somebody's not holy, but, you know, he didn't start life a wealthy man, so he accumulated wealth throughout his life. And it's one of those things, is that a barrier to canonization? Well, no, but it might be an indication that the church would really hesitate before putting somebody like that forward.
Yeah.
So what do you see about Chesterton? I mean, about his life?
Well, I'm going to rhetorically sidetrack that question, in the sense that what I'm going to say is that I think there's been a bias in the church, and it's a clerical bias, that it's much more likely that someone will be canonized because they're a celibate. Mm-hmm. And I think there's been definitely an absence of married people being canonized. I remember I was at the canonization of St. John of Bretagne-Mola, 2005, maybe 2006. And she was one of about 12 or so people being canonized that day. And she was the only one that wasn't a priest or religious.
Okay.
And there's an argument, for instance, that Chesterton should be canonized with his wife Frances, that they should be canonized as a married couple because of what they exemplify as the one flesh, if you like, of what Christian understanding of marriage is. And I do think, you know, that we shouldn't be expecting of someone who has the vocation to marriage to be living exactly the same sort of austere, ascetic lifestyle that we would hope that a religious would have, because they've taken vows, at least the religious, not necessarily obviously secular clergy, but religious have taken vows of poverty, chastity and obedience, and you'd hope and expect, in fact, having taken the vows. Whereas, you know, that Christians take Christians in marriage take a different vow, right? Which is not love, honor, and obey, till death do part, sickness and health. And there's a great deal of sanctity in that path to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we can certainly see in Chesterton's marriage to Francis, this exemplary understanding of what it is to be a spouse, what it is to be a husband, and in her, what it is to be a wife. And I think in this day and age when marriage is under attack,
mm-hmm.
I think seeing that model of matrimonial life lived sacramentally is crucial and important.
Well, I like that a lot, right? I mean, there's a parallel there with Louis and Zélie Martin, of course, right?
Indeed.
Who you know, now there's some pretty evident extraordinary suffering, and, you know, with Zélie's breast cancer and Louis's psychological problems and so on. But they were a wealthy couple, right? Who lived a prosperous middle class life and so forth. Now there's some, you know, when she died, he leaves behind his job to care for the daughters and so forth. I mean, there's some specification there that we could give to that, but let's just grant it, right? That outwardly it's a conforming middle class existence for the Martin. And they're canonized. So, prima facie, you're making a good case here. But let me just press a little bit further and say, okay, we're sympathetic. We know we need to be looking for a different kind of holiness here. give me your 30-second elevator pitch, right? What? Show me the sanctity that's not in the books and not in the childlike spirit of wonder, which we admire, right? But show me the heroic charity.
Well, I would say, first of all, that Francis and Gilbert Chesterton certainly had that suffering. They had that life of the cross, not merely because that's what marriage is, but they greatly desired children, and Francis was not able to have children. They carried that cross. There's a chapter in my biography of Chesterton called Uncle Chestnut, where we see how much Chesterton really loved children, and was the godfather to many children, but was not able to become a father himself. They carried that cross with great humility and forbearance, and they were just loyal to each other. I mean, you can say, well, there's many other people that's true of. Not enough, though. Right. And you certainly could argue that if a husband and wife have lived and raised a family and been loyal to each other, and there's no suggestion whatsoever of dalliance and, adultery and things like that, and there certainly is none of that with Chesterton or Francis, that's a holy life. Now, you can't canonize every couple that applies to, but I would argue that insofar as they've achieved that, and they've raised a family, and in Francis' case, they couldn't, but that's a separate cross. That's a path to sanctity, and I really think it would be healthy in our day and age when the church, when the family is under siege, for the church to actually start saying, well, where we can see lives of self-sacrifice, where people have taken the marriage vow seriously and have genuinely become one flesh in laying down their life for the other in the sacrament of marriage, they should be held up as exemplars of sanctity. And in that, I think that should be, I would like to see far more married people and indeed married couples. Mm. I think the Martins should be the blazing a trail for many others. And I see no reason that Gilbert and Francis Chesterton can't be amongst them.
Good. Well, that's a very good case, and this is a fascinating topic here, the topic of canonization, who's worthy of the sort of public recognition, placing the person on the altars for the intercession by the faithful and so on. And certainly G.K. Chesterton has had a tremendous impact for the spiritual good of thousands upon thousands of people. Christians and non-Christians around the world. So there is a case to be made.
Yeah,
so,
and I would say, Chris, that I'm not, I don't think that someone should be canonized because he has a fan club.
Right.
Right. And up to a point, I'm not as great an advocate for chest canonization as some people. I do believe that. Look, let's pray for miracles. If there's miracles, the question's answered. If there's not miracles, it's not answered. And I'm quite happy to be there, and I'm quite happy to be patient. And all in God's good time. If it's in God's good time that G.K. Chesterton's recognized publicly by the church as being amongst the canon of the saints, hallelujah. But if not, I believe he's there anyway.
Exactly. And then November 1st is his feast day.
November the 1st is his feast day. Yes, with numerous others. Please God.
And with his dear spouse. That's
right. Yes, indeed.
Well, that's a marvelous place to end. Thank you for consenting to be interrogated, Joseph. And thank you for inviting me to be a guest host.
You're a wonderful inquisitor.
And to all of you who've tuned into this Faith and Culture podcast from the Augustine Institute, we thank you and wish God's blessings upon you. Go.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Faith and Culture. Faith and Culture is a production of the Augustine Institute. For more information, please visit us at faithandculture.com.